When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell Tovey, I am feeling like a sullen girl.
Go on.
For some weird reason, every time I look at today's guest's beautiful figurative paintings, I sing a song to myself, which is some weird sort of synapse or whatever you call it in my brain. But it links me to the days when I spent literally 24/7 listening to the album Tidal by Fiona Apple. And Fiona Apple isn't as big in the UK as she is in America, but I was spending a lot of time back then making music in Canada, and I was obsessed with her. And for some reason, I was looking at Aubrey's paintings the other day, and I was literally like, days like this, I don't know what to do with myself. And singing that song, Sullen Girl. And then I just thought, well, I am a sullen girl, aren't I? And
you are a sullen girl.
The works of today's guest have a melancholy, a kind of incredible atmosphere, and a really extraordinary colour palette, which I am so excited to discuss, because it's just really incredible and her work really stands out. And I think right now there's obviously a lot of figurative painting that's been coming through, rightly so. And it feels like a kind of return in a way to people accepting all different kinds of painting, because also there's a whole abstract movement at the moment, especially in the UK, happening. And actually even your show, Russ, at Sim Smith that you curated. But I actually think today's guest is just one of the greats of this group of artists who are working at the moment. And it's a really singular voice that comes through in the work. And anyway, we will discuss it. But I'm not suggesting today's guest is sullen. I'm just saying that
saying
I am.
You are.
Yeah.
You're sullen.
I am a misery is where we're at.
We
would like to welcome to Talk Art, Aubrey Leventhal. Hi, Aubrey.
Hi, thank you so much.
How are you?
Good, thank you for that. That was a fun introduction.
Do you know Fiona Apple? Do you know Sullen Girl? Is that a song that you have on repeat in the studio?
Can you imagine?
Well, I was like, yep. Yeah, I definitely was into that in my like middle school years. And honestly, recently, I feel like people are into her again all of a sudden. I feel like she's been on some of my Spotify mixes all of a sudden. It's interesting that you bring her up.
She's so cool. She was a rebel. And she stuck to her guns. Love her.
You're right. Yeah.
Where do we find you today?
I'm in my studio in South Philadelphia. It's about 3
and it was,
in the afternoon.
It was Philadelphia born and raised, right?
Yeah.
That's where... And you've always, you went to school there and you studied there. And have you ever felt the urge to leave Philadelphia? Because now we're looking at you and you're in your studio in Philadelphia. It feels like Philadelphia is everything.
I never was like, oh, I have to be in Philadelphia forever. This is the place. You know, I was never like a diehard, but it's always worked really beautifully. And I do love it. It was great as an art student. It's affordable. There's a lot going on. It kind of has like an undercurrent that, you know, it's like a second tier city here, but it's like, it's not so I don't know, like corporate. It's kind of, you can do what you want. You can find what you need and do what you want, kind of. And so, and it's close to New York. So I've always loved it. And, you know, of course, family's here and everything else. So it does feel weird that I'm, you know, they say like in Pennsylvania, it's the state where you're the most likely to live and die. And I'm like, oh God, am I going to be one of those?
Aubrey, it feels like it. Feels like, you know, it feels like, especially Philadelphia is so embedded in the work as well. Like you look at for people coming to your work, it's your everyday. It's your life. It's you walking around, what you observe, your local stores, the people you see in the park, your experiences when you're driving the car. These things are very embedded in the city that you're in.
Yes. And I feel like whenever I think about moving, I'm like, where would I move? Nothing looks the way I like it to look, except here in a certain way. And it's funny because people will ask me also, you know, where does the color come from? And I think I didn't realize it until I traveled a bit, but it's like Philadelphia is a gray, silvery gray place. And so it's sort of just a reflection of what I'm seeing.
Oh, really? Like the light there is different.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just always, it's always raining. It's always gray. You guys can probably.
You should come to London. I think your work will fit in perfectly.
That'll be, yeah.
Although with global warming, who knows? I think London might end up being a sun spot.
Heavy stuff.
Well, that actually leads us into this idea then that I brought up in the intro, which is your color palette. And I think it is a good thing to start the conversation with in a way, because I think that's what sets your paintings apart and make them so you. It's this kind of like muted, very gentle colors, but at the same time, quite, washed out colors, but also colors that jar sometimes too, somehow. I don't know. There's always a kind of a tension between some of the color choices.
Yeah. Color feels so hard to discuss when I'm teaching or when I'm just trying to explain it further. It does seem like the one formal thing that is so innate, like it's so in the painter, I think, in a certain way. I think I often will try to go against that, and I'll lay down, especially recently I've been putting down grounds of much brighter colors and then sort of using that to work against or try to work into, and inevitably the paintings kind of land in a similar place. I mean, earlier my work was higher in key, but I think it's sort of that when I found that place where there's that nuance, like the muted color sings kind of next to a few vibrating brighter saturated moments, that's just always feels so right. It ends up being where they stay.
But that is naturally where you go. You don't find yourself kind of going brighter and then bringing it back to these muted kind of grays and yellows and browns. This is the palette that you like happily sit within.
Yeah. I mean, I do think I try to push it the other way. Like for a long time, I would start paintings and they would kind of always stay in that silvery, like lightish gray. But I have tried to build brighter ground, and then they'll inevitably kind of get muted. I'd work in a lot of like glazing and kind of pulling things off with a utility blade and then washing back in. So the color often ends up getting that kind of muddy, nuanced in between kind of that. I don't know. I just respond so much to that.
And you work on a wooden panel a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Almost all the work is on panel at this point. Yeah.
How did that come into play? Like as a painter, you would just like, the assumption is you would go straight to canvas.
Right. Yeah. I worked on canvas for a long time, like in school, and was always tending towards the kind of working with thin paint, and everyone would say like build it up, and I would build it up, but it never felt right, so I would scrape it back. And I finally was working on like small little, you know, throwaway masonite kind of panels. And the way that you can scrape on that, you can really push and almost like get all of the paint off. So it kind of held up against the kind of like scraping and erasing that I like to do. So it just, you know, I kept gravitating toward that. And now at this point, I've just kind of given in.
And that scraping technique is done with a razor blade, right? This is something you kind of scratch over the surface once you've created the image.
Yeah. So when I first was doing that, it was probably with a palette knife, but I wanted something sharper. And I have very lazy habits in the studio. I have like all these utility blades. I have like a 50 pack of utility blades that I had been using to clean my palette. And just started using them on the paintings, and now that's like one of the things I can't paint without. I have to have big supply of the little rectangular blades.
Is there anything in you that feels kind of terrified every time if you're happy with an image and then you go at it with a blade? Is there a part of you that thinks, what if I, you know, hack a lump out, or I'm going to destroy the surface of this?
That's part of the excitement, surely.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's what it's all about. It's like you have to take out the good parts, and I mean, usually you're trying to take the bad, but a lot of it goes, and then I think that's really for me the whole joy of it is the making and not knowing what's going to come up. And so I think particularly earlier on, the work was so much about pulling back and seeing what would kind of bubble to the surface, and then working from that and kind of like having a conversation with the paint as it develops.
There's also a real feeling of fragility is what I often think when I look at the work. If you think of like you a few years ago, the series of paintings you were making, say in 2020, there's something like, there's an amazing one of the subway where you've got the plastic bags, like the shopping bags. And there's something so sort of fragile that you could imagine those bags just literally blowing away or collapsing. And you know what I mean? Like, even though they might have stuff in them, you've got that element of air. And I like the idea of that scraping away as well, somehow to create that energy of fragility within the pictorial image.
Yeah, I love that. I think that is a big part of it, that kind of ghostly, almost being there. And also when things kind of reverse, like I guess a plastic bag is somewhat fragile, but I like when things, like often the figures will feel almost like they're disappearing. I like the reversal of something solid becoming sort of lost in the paint. So I think often that's how that happens, like using the blade, or I'll often dip my rags in the solvent and like pull them back. So
but it's also like, it's not actually just fragility, it's like a flimsiness. I think that was the word I was actually going for, probably. And like, even sometimes the shapes of furniture or the body shapes themselves, there's kind of like a bendy, even like the plastic, in a sense, like that plastic bag, like it can move into different shapes and be molded. And they're quite sort of visceral. It kind of makes me feel all this kind of, that's kind of what's in my head anyway.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that they're not kind of still and wooden carved out, but kind of maybe able to breathe a little bit. That's a goal. So that's nice.
Yeah, there is air in there, but also there's a passing of time because there's a lot of food appears. Yeah. But some of it's fresh, some of it's rotten. Right. There's flowers. Some of them are wilting. Some of them are upright plants. So there's this passage of time. And even though we might be seeing this figure in one domestic situation, around them, there is time passing through these tropes of like art history. Like the still life is something art history. You see that rot. It's about how we as humanity are rotting away.
Right.
These elements, when did you hit on that you wanted to combine the still life but the movement and that art historical context as well?
I don't know when it started, but I was made aware of it kind of recently. I didn't even realize I was using so many things that mark that time is passing in the still image until it was pointed out to me by a painter friend. But like the banana and the flowers. They just, I think they do. They suggest movement the same way that we were just talking about. And so that's really, I don't know, that's attractive to me. And then
the watch as well is in there a lot of
the time. The watch is often in there. I think it's maybe started with trying to sort of like paint the accumulation of a memory. So it's not just like, oh, this one time something happened, but rather like constantly sitting at the same table or constantly looking at the same cup. And how do you sort of paint that into a still image? I don't know, but I like that question. I think that often comes up for me. So something to do with that.
I love the concept that the painting is sort of in charge of you. The fact that your friend pointed it out to you, even though you're the creator of it, you're putting it out there, but your friend's the one who says to you, you do realize you're doing this. It's these instincts that you have, but it's like the paintings are telling you what they want to be rather than you being in complete control. That's quite an incredible vibe to be in when you're making work.
That's where it's really exciting for me to make the painting. I think in that space where it feels like it's just instinctive response to the work. And I've had it where, I think especially in school, there was this urge to think about painting in a way that was more like how a conceptual artist would think, of understanding what you're doing and why, and wanting to do that beforehand or wanting to narrow down into a series. And that was very limiting and made the worst painting. So I think through time of having done that and it not working, I've tried to find ways to put parameters in that make it so that I don't actually know what's going to come about exactly. I kind of try to keep those things open, give myself new questions, whether it's, you know, do I paint, like I said, with a different ground, or do I, start a painting from life instead of from shape? So just always trying to kind of challenge what I've done so that there are those places where it doesn't feel like I'm so in control.
Yeah, like having spontaneity or like keeping it alive, I guess.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of the things that are most exciting to me in the end, I couldn't have thought of before making the paintings. They just are a result of the process. So,
did you ever, when it comes to the figure, we're in like a figurative renaissance. And I know that when I first started collecting, people were telling me painting's dead and the figure's dead. Did you ever at any point when you were making work and you were obviously inspired by yourself and the figure and the domestic, did anyone ever say, don't do that? Did anyone ever warn you not to make work like that because it wouldn't be successful?
I think maybe not outright, but it was definitely a feeling that, well, why paint this? And what's the point? There was much more resistance to it when I was in school. Of course, I did for graduate school go to the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, so that is very much like figurative in its tradition. I saw once they had a Fairfield Porter painting hanging in the museum and was like, okay, I need to go here. But I think definitely it was much more why do that? And now I don't think that's really asked so much.
No, definitely. Do you feel like you're part of this figurative movement? Because there is, and there is a lot of attention. You and you're part of your peers as well. There's a lot of, support and enthusiasm. And do you feel like you're in kind of a golden age of figure in painting right now?
I feel really honored that you would say that. I think I get very excited when I look around and see, there are so many people painting things that are really exciting to me. And I don't feel like that was as much the case, years back. But it does feel like there is interest in figure. And it never made sense to me that it would be not something to paint, because it's maybe cycles, but it always comes back to the figure.
And actually, if you look at your body of work this far, there's the protagonist in it is often this female figure who I take it is the self-portrait of yourself, I guess. And it's almost like when you see, you know, numerous paintings from over the past, say, 5 years, they become like this kind of patchwork quilt of like of experience, of life, of like what it's like to live right now on Earth, and a very interior perspective, but also just like a kind of presentation of like the culture as well around us, like the actual everyday. Is there, if you were installing a show, do you think in like terms of timeline or narrative? Because it's almost, for me, there are these kind of like, it's like a whole life, like almost like a film kind of rolling in front of you. Or maybe like a I don't know, this very personal diaries. A poet might write, you know, like, I don't know, like Sylvia Plath or somebody used to write about their experiences, like, you know, the light coming in through the window, their reflections, these interior moments. Like, I think when you put them all together, it's so powerful. And I was thinking, if I was you, I'd really struggle to like install a show, unless I was interested how you see that kind of process.
I do. I think I do like to see them all together. It does feel like new things, threads come between them, but I often let the galleries do that, because I think sometimes I get too close. You know, I'm close to the paintings for months, I'm close to the subject matter, so often I'll maybe think too practically, or think, oh, now that I have to look and make a show, and think in ways that are too linear. So I think sometimes it's better for someone else's eyes to kind of have a new read, and it could be more poetic often that way.
And as they're so personal and is you, have you ever regretted selling any of them? Are there any of them that you wish you kept
that's
back?
Funny. For the most part, no. I would say for the most part, when they're done, I'm fine getting rid of them. There was one Breakfast at 13th that was really more particularly like a family portrait than most things I've done, and I really liked that painting, so I don't know if I regret it, but I wouldn't mind still looking at that one.
And what does it feel like knowing that there's portraits of you in random people's houses around the world, looking at them, you're looking at them and living with them?
I liked, someone said about them that they're self-portraits by half, and I think that's how I think of it, and it makes me feel more comfortable with that idea. They're kind of a fictionalized.
By half, what do you mean? What does that mean?
Like, they're sort of self-portraits, but there's someone else in there. I don't know. They've been reworked enough to become kind of their own. Oftentimes, like, they'll start as a more specific thing to my living room or something, and then they'll become, you know, a couch color I don't have, or, you know, even, you know, just sort of wonk out in different ways that it becomes much less about my own, like, likeness or the space's likeness, and sort of about its own reality. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I also feel like the viewer can complete the work, maybe, or it becomes, in your work very specifically, though, I'm not just saying this generally, like, there's something, I know they always talk about, if you think of Matisse, and I don't know, there's artists like John McAllister, and there's loads of people now that think about, like, windows, and, you know, you look out of the window, but I feel like with yours, it's kind of looking in the window, maybe, or like you're sat on the table next to you in the cafe, looking at you across. I feel like somehow, as a viewer, you almost feel like you're actually in that scene, and that's why they also make me think of a film, because I feel like you're almost encouraging us to become creative in our interaction with the work, which I don't think about in a lot of figurative painting. Actually, it's like
I do like that a lot, and I like to use mirrors a lot too, because they kind of force that, where once you stand in front of the painting, it becomes your reflection, so there is this kind of like rather than being a voyeur into the painting, you become, you complete it. I've never heard it.
Or like a participant. Participant. And you're right. It's not creepy, because there are some paintings where the painter, like, obviously might use that as a tool, like what they want you to feel, like, uncomfortable, or whatever, like a voyeur. But I feel in yours, you're actually just you're part of the world. Like, you're welcome.
I like that. Yeah, like there's sort of like you're alongside the private moment, but not in like a not in an assertive way. Yeah, I don't know. I like that.
Yeah, you're experiencing the space at the same time. It's not like it's your time and our time. It's like you're then part of the same conversation.
I like that. I like that a lot.
We talked to so many artists during lockdown, and you was an artist that I discovered during lockdown. And I think you were someone that I saw regularly really creating a language about what it was like to be in the lockdown and you know, to be described as a sullen girl, which Rob said with a song, but melancholy and the mundane and this time passing, which is a big medium for you to work in, is this passing of time. But there were so many paintings that you created, and a whole series of these nightstand series. I think there were six of them. Where it was you basically in the same position on the bed, and you just assume it's on a different day, and it feels like this is what it is today. This is what it is today. It's this repetitive action. And I found it fascinating. And I found, like with a lot of artists that were working during that time, you were someone that really moved with the lockdown. It was something that felt like it really inspired your work. And it's taken it somewhere else since before lockdown and after lockdown.
Yeah. I made a joke to a friend, like, I feel like I went through the anxiety-ridden feeling of COVID like about 6 months before everyone else. So it just worked out that it makes sense. No, but I do. I think I really do tend to make paintings in response to what I'm seeing. And it's not even that I understand it in the time that it's happening, but like with those paintings I was very nervous too. Ooh, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, I was getting a beep. Sorry, is that?
We can definitely hear you still.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just keep getting a beep in my ear.
Oh, maybe.
Have they got batteries in or anything?
Okay, I think it's gone.
Okay.
I with those paintings of the nightstand, I was working from home. I was too nervous to go into the studio building, so I brought everything home. I was working in the basement, so I would be upstairs, look around, go down, make the painting. And I even worked in the bedroom. There was a painting called Bed, and I pretty much worked from looking at my bed, so it was very much sort of like directly from life, which is how I worked earlier on. So yeah, I think I just noticed the way, like the shape of that window and that dresser every day, and it sort of bore a shape into my brain, and I needed to paint it. And
Was it sort of therapy in some ways? Did you find it as your way of channeling these anxieties of that time?
I don't know. I wouldn't say so. I think painting is very hard and creates more anxiety, but it does in the end. If I haven't painted in a couple of days, I'm like, why am I feeling like this? And then I go paint and I feel better. So it kind of mimics life, I think. It's like this mini world of things are going horribly, things are going amazingly, you know. It's like it's all in a couple hours span. But I don't know that it feels directly like a cathartic thing sometimes, but often it's kind of feels more like a slog to me.
Why is it hard then? Why is that something that, so art isn't fun, art is hard and
no, it is fun. Yeah, it's kind of that, like, the best of times are when you're, you know, like, things aren't, it's just that up and down, that kind of roller coaster of like, oh, I have this idea, the painting's so exciting, you go to the bathroom, you come back, oh, it looks like shit, I gotta, you know, it's just, there's excitement in the kind of struggle, I guess, of making the painting. And yeah, I don't know. I don't think I would like painting to be just kind of this, you know, what you see, like a plein air person out. I think whenever I've done plein air, I'm like in a life or death match. Like, I'm out there so stressed out and people are coming by looking and it's awful. I think it's a myth that to make a good painting, you're in this like relaxed, at least for me, this like kind of like relaxed state of mind. I don't know about that.
Do you sketch before everything?
Yeah, I tend to draw figures in certain poses, like pull them from some of my books or from life or from a photo. And then that's often where the beginning of the painting will be. Like, I'll lay a ground and then kind of set in some shapes and line related to that pose. Mm.
I listened to an interview where it said that where your inspiration came from and where you were told in your formative years that you could be an artist. And your mum was really formative in that, because she showed you many women artists. Mm-hmm. And she said that if you want to be an artist, these are artists that are women, like Georgia O'Keeffe, I think you mentioned, Mary Cassatt. So mm-hmm. you had a real support from a young age. And then there's this incredible story you said about this sketch you found as a five-year-old that you made. Yeah. And it's almost like you're a fortune teller. This feels like it's quite witchy, the image. Yeah. I'd love you to speak about, you know, that the promotion of your mum for you as a kid, and also this sketch that you now live with.
Oh yeah. So she found the sketch I had done, I guess it was in kindergarten, where everyone had to say what their magic hat would let them be in the future. And mine said I would be an artist. And it's a picture of me drawing a picture of me. It's like a little easel.
And you're five, like, right? You're 5 years yeah. old then. That's yeah. so crazy.
It is. And it's pretty surreal, because I, as much as I wanted it, I don't know that I thought it could happen. So yeah, she was formative in that she had books around and yeah, would, I think I was a kid who was very much sort of like would go, it's interesting because my son now is five and he's so different. And so only by comparison do I realize, like, I would go inward and go and read and make things and like draw, where he, when he's feeling bored, expands out and like wants to go out into the neighborhood and see, you know, so it's very and see people. I don't know, it's just kind of, again, like something that seems very much embedded in there somehow.
What would his magic hat do for him, do you know?
Make him tall enough to be a basketball player. Yeah.
There's a painting in that, I think.
Right.
Him trying to put the ball in the net. You know, I mentioned the idea of jarring colours. It might not be something that people immediately think of, but for me, the reason I said it is because in your work, there seems to be this recurring theme of either objects. It could be like flowers or a piece of cake or even cherry tart, because that was one of the things that I really spotted myself. And I don't know if this is just me noticing it in the work, but
angry.
I feel like there's no. That it's also elemental. So it could be like water, but there's also moments where you even have like a swimming pool. But often you use color to kind of highlight one thing in particular. It's almost like there's a spotlight, and I don't know if it's deliberate, and it could just be a compositional thing, like it's a balance, you know, of making the image. But even the one where you're lying on a sofa and it's this kind of yellow velvet, and then the piping of the cushion, and I only noticed it because I've been recently restoring old furniture, and I've done you know, I now understand all about this piping and how they put it all together. But even the piping, it's like that's the color in that one painting, which is like this incredible jarring kind of moment. And there's other places where you've got like I don't know, something on a table, and there'll be one like toothbrush or something that's like a really lime green against everything else that's very silver. I love that in the work, this kind of spotlighting and pinpointing of objects, because for me it's like that interior world when you're a kid and you might feel like a bit lost or a bit bored even, and just like the repetition of the daily thing, but you somehow get joy out of a book or out of, you know, one object, and it somehow keeps your focus. I loved it, and it took me back to childhood. Is that something that's deliberate, or is it just part of making a work?
Yeah, you're someone that loves objects. It's obvious.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we all are.
Oh, okay. Thank you for saying that. I think it's born out of a couple things. I think when I make the paintings, they feel very kind of wishy-washy at the beginning, where, you know, I'll put in a big tablecloth that's pink or something, and then I'll need something that focuses your eye, but also the way that I think like memory functions, that kind of you were alluding to, where something really grabs you and you remember it, and other things are kind of at the periphery. I really like to try to mimic that. I think Bonnard's a master of that, where you know, you can even, some of his paintings, you'll look at it, you won't even notice that a figure is like in the space, and then slowly that comes into focus. So yeah, I think it helps with that feeling. I also think it makes the time, like we were talking about earlier, the way time passes, it kind of it will make you move around the painting in a certain way, where like a pattern or something very bright or a sort of vibrating moment will make you look a second time or revisit that spot. And so that feels important both to the subject, like the feeling I'm trying to get across maybe, but also compositionally it feels like the painting needs it. So sometimes I'll even like bring in like an actual toothbrush. I have actually for the painting, Russell, that you have, for the Grimm show, this you might recognize.
Yes. There's a clock
in
the painting, and I actually brought the clocking because I needed like a very specific kind of graphic moment, I felt.
Do you think you're giving us a map to navigate your paintings, the way that you're highlighting, the way that things ping out, the way that your focus is taking you around on a journey of the plane?
Yeah. I think I'm trying to suggest it maybe, and I like when the paintings reveal themselves slowly. So I do think, you know, what comes up first or how it appears at first, and then hopefully the longer you look, there's a reward, whether something comes into focus or, you know, you want to return to some part of it. I do think a lot about that.
Oh, yeah, I've got a painting which is fruit with toaster reflection, and it's one I return to all the time, and I look and I go, oh my god, I've not seen that before. There's a pineapple. I didn't even see the pineapple.
Yeah,
oh my god,
yeah,
there you are. I had it for a while and I was like, oh my god, she's in the toaster, that's the reflection. I was always going, what's the reflection? Because there's a knife there, and it's they are, you can, your works, you return to them, and because of this like passing of time that you're able to contain within the plane, you, it always is constantly revealing something to you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
There's
a story that you said, which I've read about, which is currently you have a work up at the Flag Art Foundation, which we can come to. But I was reading the text for that by Alexi Worth, and she said a quote that Catherine Bradford, who's an artist that we love, came to visit you and came to see your work. And she said to you, "Why can't there be a Diet Coke?"
Right.
And this was something for you which unlocked everything. And I'd love to talk about that, because that seems such a simple line, but actually that feels like it gave you permission to just make it you.
I mean, she was so magical to have in. And so I had been making all these paintings of these sort of old, like, I wouldn't say nostalgic, but more kind of like they felt even more sort of the time, you know, they were like stills from old family movies or whatever. So I was painting these beautiful kind of tablecloths like over top of these china plates and all these different things. And she said, "Why can't there be a Diet Coke?" And it's like, yeah, why can't there be the things that are on the table? And I think that kind of slowly over, I mean, it's been what, almost 12 years since she probably said that, at least, this feeling of being more particular about when I place, like what places you in a particular time period. So like a Diet Coke, or in that piece, Alexi was saying that he felt it was all about the AirPod in the one woman's ear that put you in 2023. So yeah, I find that kind of fun too, like what signifies a time.
They'll end up being time capsules as well. The fact that there's an earpod, you know, in 5 years we might not have earpods; they'll just be embedded.
I used to paint them with a string. But I refused to paint masks. I did not paint a single mask, and I'm proud of it. So hopefully that'll recede out of our minds.
What was the object you held up? Because I just realized the listener probably won't have seen that. You know, you mentioned, because Russell's curated this exhibition called Close, which is going to be at Grimm Gallery in London, and it opens on the 4th of March, 2023, and it runs until the 6th of April. And it includes a number of different artists, and it's around this idea of the kind of domestic, I guess, isn't it, Russ?
Quiet moments of domestic joy, celebrating those,
So what was the object that you said was in the painting that's going to be in that show?
It was this little clock that's like shaped like an apple, and
An apple clock.
It's kind of a great color and shape, so I was thinking of it because I look at it all the time, but then I needed kind of to really look from life to put it in there, so I brought it.
And it's very much your color palette. It's that lime green that sometimes punctuates certain paintings for sure. And for those listening, it's quite cartoony in shape in a way. It's not like a Apple, the brand, it's more like a kind of sliced an apple in half on little feet.
And then it's made it into a clock.
It's very anthropomorphic.
Yeah.
If that's the right word.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Are you still there? I think we've...
Yeah.
Okay, we've lost your image. But anyway, if you can hear us. So, so as I said, you've got a painting up right now at the Flag Art Foundation. And the Flag Art Foundation is a non-profit exhibition space which has in New York, in Manhattan, which has rotating exhibitions of contemporary art. And they do these spotlight exhibitions where it's an artwork which hasn't been seen publicly. And they pair the artist up, the artwork, and a writer. In this case, it was Alexi Worth, who was just talking about. The Flag Art Foundation is a big deal. I've seen many exhibitions there. I mean, and this spotlights before Honor Titus, Shara Hughes, Elisa Nissenbaum, lots of incredible artists have had this spotlight. What has that process been like? And what is it? Can you talk about that particular painting and why you chose that one to be your spotlight?
Sure. Yeah, it's been great to work with Flag. Like you said, I saw so many shows there before they invited me to have this one painting on this wall. And it's really a nice thing where they pair you with a written piece, the painting. And so Alexi and I got to talk a lot about sort of, we talked a lot about, like I had said, the time, what makes a painting feel contemporary or of a certain time. And that was an interesting thing to kind of parse with him. That painting just was one of those lucky ones where I was walking through that park, which I walk through almost every day, and it just hit me that like I knew what I needed to make a painting of, that I had been looking for a winter coat. And so, you know how, like, when, if you're looking for, let's say, like a new mug, then you look at everyone's mug and you're like, oh, that's nice. That's nice. I like that. You know, you start to get, or like someone's bathroom, like tile or something. So I was like in this quest for a coat. And so I started noticing coats and just the shape, the way that like they become these like big solid shapes moving around. And it's like the person barely exists within this thing. I just thought that's an amazing painting. That's so funny. It just hit the note that I love. Like, it's funny, but it's, I don't know, like these isolated little shapes. So yeah, it just kind of hit me at once. And then I went home and, or went to the studio and made a bunch of little drawings. And from there, it just like kept kind of adding to it as I would walk through, look, see what else I wanted to add to the painting. And so it felt so important, and like I made it, like I work on maybe 10 paintings at a time, so often they're slow and turn them around, put them back, but that one just like kept working and I kept feeling what needed to happen with it. And so it felt like this singular thing. So when they approached me with having just one painting, that felt really like the right one.
So the painting came first and then they approached you, or did it come the other way around?
They had said they were interested and to let them know if something came up in the next, you know, like 6 months to a year of making work that made sense. And so when that one happened, I sort of like thought, oh, this would be something to ask if they would be interested in.
And talking about humor, Alexi says in one of the figures, which I think is the closest to you, and it looks like she's headbutting the side of the panel, which I love. As soon as I read that, I was like, it does. It looks like this woman's literally got the headbutt away out of the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's like she's so kind of miserable that it's funny. And so for me, I think sometimes people want to talk about the melancholy, and that's for sure there, but also I love when it's tempered with a kind of humor, or I don't know, there's just something with like her that felt so right. She almost feels like lifted out of some painting from art history and flunked there, and not quite right for her to remain. So she, kind of desperate.
I think those moments of wit and humor like persist through the work. Like it appears every so often. And there's that amazing painting of like loads of kind of suits at a desk, like at like a workplace or something, all these men kind of like in lined around a table. And then you've got the figure of the woman just like, sort of like, oh God. And it made me think about like the personal being political as well. And whether there's some element of like, I don't know, social commentary within it, like this kind of like humorous underlining throughout the work.
You know what? That is the one painting I'll say that felt like a cathartic. It wasn't therapy, but it was so directly related to going to a faculty meeting and being like, I need to rid this and make a painting. So that was kind of direct. Life experience.
A satire of
to
the
shake
patriarchy.
It off. Yeah.
One of my favorite things about your work, and I hope that everybody listening when they come to your work will start noticing it now, is the way you sign your paintings. I am obsessed. You know,
a Russell Tovey comment.
We all love an artist signature. Everybody loves an artist signature. Everybody loves a title and a date. But you scratch in your surname in the bottom right-hand corner of everything, and sometimes it's muted, and sometimes it's very clear. But it's the way that your kind of font that you've created to write your name with that. I'm obsessed. And every time
that's
I see a painting,
funny.
That's one of the first things I look at, is the way that that's you've signed so your name funny. In the corner.
Huh. No one's ever said that, but I appreciate that. Yeah. I look at signatures a lot too. I find them so interesting. Like Mirandi is so quiet, and then his signature is so big.
Yes.
So strange, but always put in the right place compositionally. I don't know when I started doing that, but it just it was a good way to be able to, like you said, either disguise it if the composition needed that, or, you know, some paintings can hold like a bigger, stronger font and it doesn't affect it. So yeah, and my name is strangely, like, everything is straight lines, and I seem to do a lot of things on the grid in the paintings. So somehow the shape of the letter is capitalized, just always seems to
work.
Yes,
I think that's it. Yeah, I think it's very satisfying. It's a very satisfying, because they're all in capitals.
Mm.
And it's and have you always scraped it in, or was that something that you kind of thought,
I think,
oh, this
almost
is what I
always
do?
Have scraped it. I mean, yeah, pretty much any paintings that I've that are out in the world probably have a similar signature. It's been a while.
Well, I hope everyone else notices that now.
You know what else? Like, when I was looking at the work, when Russ first told me about you maybe 6 months ago or so, he's so good at spotting people because all he does is geek out 24/7 when he's not filming, like searching people out all the time. But I really distinctly remember him telling me about your work. And I remember thinking, like, it was so precise. That was my first thought about your work, was it was very like ordered somehow and almost like meticulous in nature. But then I saw photographs taken in your studio and I saw your palette, like almost like, you know, what you would mix your paints with. And there was a furiousness. I don't mean anger. I mean more like vitality, or like an urgency within the way that you're mixing your paints and the way you're getting your colors. It's quite messy, actually.
Yeah.
And it wasn't at all. It was totally opposite to what the work is. And I was fascinated to ask you what it's like in your studio. Like, is it a mess?
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, I think generally in life I'm pretty organized, but in the studio it is. It's like, that's the worst habit. I never clean off and it's kind of purposeful, I think, because then, yeah, nice colors come up, and I never clean my brushes because I love that, you know, sludge that forms. And yeah, it's pretty bad. It's like, there's so many, I'm looking around now, there's so many rags that are like a fire hazard probably, and so many half finished paintings. Yeah, it feels like that is where things, again, like the way that things come out of the panel, maybe like they'll just start to like kind of bubble up if there's enough mess going on around the easel.
Wow, so it's like a chaos, and then the clarity of the image reveals itself. It comes to life in front of you, like an apparition.
I'm just giving myself a reason never to, clean
to
my
tidy up.
Is there a lot of empty?
It's very romantic.
Is there a lot of empty wine bottles and rotten fruit in there as well?
Yes, I mean, let's see. Right now, yeah, there's a couple things. There's a couple things in different states of decay.
That's so funny. I was in my friend's car the other day, and every time I get in his car, there's always like a moldy, like banana peel, or like
that?
A half-eaten apple core. Just somebody I work
who's
with.
That?
Just somebody I work with, and because they have a family, obviously, and I think their kids must just throw things down.
Right.
Often in the, you know, the compartments and in the door of the car,
oh,
it's just like packed full of stuff.
Put your hand in there. Oh god.
Yeah. Oh my god.
That's so grim.
I used to, when I taught still life, I would, I had pieces of cake that I like cut, and they hardened over time, and they were just perfect. Like, I could just pull them out like they were actually, you know, made of plastic or something, but they really were, they were real at one point. And I used to make paper mache objects, like of cake and of different things. So they're always laying around the studio too. I actually have a rotten banana paper mache right across looking at right now.
How did that come about, like paper mache? Like,
I don't know, I had the urge to do that, and it was at a time I was pregnant, and so I made, it was for this little show in this tiny room in the painting center that felt almost like a refrigerator, and so I made this show called Refrigerator Paintings, and the objects were things that I craved and things that I couldn't have, and I don't know, it was just funny to me, and so they all like live in the studio now, because where else will they go?
you know saying that you had this urge to make the papier-mâché sculptures, like, there's something about you, having spoken to you now, that I can see you're very resolute or strong within your vision of what it is you want to do. And it seems like even at times when you were told, or not necessarily told directly, but you know, that it wasn't necessarily the most interesting thing to be painting or whatever, you just were like focused and had conviction, like, and faith in yourself. Is that something that always came naturally to you? Because I think it's such good advice to artists, whatever age, just to remember that your voice is the one that's the most interesting, and that will, if you really start to listen to yourself and focus on that and forget all the noise around you, that will probably bring you the greatest rewards in life, because not only will you love the work, but the world will too, probably.
Yeah, I think it wasn't such a clean thing where I always felt that way. I think I often would try the things that were suggested or question myself. There was a lot of like doubt, but then working backwards, I always felt like I would try things and say no, no, no. And I would always come back to like these core things that I would always find. And so I think it's good to kind of eliminate, you know, to try things. But yeah, like, there were times where I just said no, like when an art critic would say, like, you should make video art. Like, no, I knew for myself that wasn't for, like, I needed to be making the thing. But there were times I would try. But yeah, I think always seeing what feels engaging and then following that thread has been really the best way forward for me.
And what's it like currently navigating the attention that you have on you? You have an amazing gallerist, Monyero Gallery in Manhattan, who I love, and I've seen exhibitions there of yours, and obviously she's got your best interests and everything. But what is it like personally for you when you suddenly have a lot of attention on your work? Does it add pressure in the studio to you, or is it something you try and shut out?
I think I shut it out when I'm in working. When I'm working, it really just becomes about the compositions and things. But it feels really nice to have galleries taking care of, like, the, you know, taking the pictures of the work, transporting it. I mean, I remember, like, you know, packing up my stuff into bags, bringing it to a show, trying to hang it. You know, it's just like to have galleries that I trust and have my best interest take care of some of that kind of stuff that goes around making the work. And also now I'm not teaching. I was teaching at like three schools at once. So it's just been, it feels honestly kind of luxurious right now.
Lovely. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah,
it's good to feel like surreal. Other people are caring for your work, I imagine, as well. Like, even just that shipping thing, the idea that it's being professionally shipped and it won't get damaged. And you know what I mean? Like, that somebody else can be responsible for caring for the artwork. I think it's fantastic.
That's amazing. I mean, I throw them around in here and then someone comes and puts it in like this beautiful handmade cardboard box and they carry it so gently. And I'm like, oh, I
always have that when I go to artist studios and they're just sort of drag their art around and pull it and flick it and throw it down. Right, and I'm like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Have respect for that. And it's like, well, it's there. It's just like it's part of them. It doesn't.
Right.
It's so funny.
So funny. So you mentioned Mirandi earlier and lots of other artists. Were there any particular artists that really you feel like gave you agency to push forward in your vision?
Any that really what? I missed that one part.
Sorry, any that gave you agency and kind of helped you push forward in your vision for what your work was?
You know, I feel like when I was in graduate school, it was like I loved the postmodern, like not the post-impressionist, like kind of Bonnard. I loved some of Matisse. And then it was Porter. I thought of that as like a kind of lineage, like Porter and Hockney. But then I think I sort of started to find painters that weren't so much in that like large canon, like they're known, but maybe not in the same way. And a lot of them were women, kind of modernists. So like Janice Viala, I love, Mary Fedden, who was Hockney's teacher. There's actually a lot of British women painters, Winifred Nicholson. So yeah, I kind of found these painter Natalie DePasque, who's like more contemporary, but kind of in this area of like nodding to these ideas of modern shape and, you know, formal things, but there's this underlying tenderness towards like objects and intimacy that maybe aren't there in some of the more known modernist painters of that time. So yeah, that really started, I just started to find sort of like these outliers that I loved. I love Gertrude Abercrombie. I love Florian Stettheimer. So not that they necessarily, I paint so much like them, but they kind of are in their corner doing their thing, and I respect that so much.
I also thought of Milton Avery.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Do you like Milton Avery?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. There's a few of them at the museum here. That there's one of the log with these birds all lined up. It's quite beautiful. Yeah. The color really is something in person.
Yeah. What is your artist community like in Philadelphia? And what are their galleries like? I'm not as familiar with it. I haven't been for a long, long time. I love the Philadelphia Museum, of course. I mean, it's iconic. But but what's the kind of like day-to-day, you know, like community of artists? Mm-hmm. Are there many friends?
Yeah. Well, I'm in a building. It's called the Bach Building, and it used to be this old technical school, and it's got a bunch of different painters in it. So that feels good, like every day to walk by, you know, people working. And then in terms of, I think there's a lot of young, emerging creative energy. There's a lot of schools here. There's a lot of co-op spaces. I think it's harder because there aren't those mid-level galleries, those sort of like commercial established spaces for artists who've been working for a while. So a lot of times, because New York's like an hour and a half away, artists will show in New York. You know, there are a lot, I have a lot of good friends here and do studio visits. So it does feel very connected here and also to New York. There's like a lot of people who know each other and will introduce you. It's a very open kind of like, it's not competitive. It's very community. So I really like that about it.
It's definitely a move globally, I think, of decentralizing, and having spaces for people to actually just have a little less pressure, both with like rent, but also just psychologically to not be in the big city and still participate and show there. But I just think it's really healthy, actually. And I think it's brilliant that you found your kind of space there.
Yeah, that was very helpful, not to have the pressure of the prices in New York, right? Because I remember everyone said, like, you have to move to New York. And you know, I had a lot of things here and didn't really see that happening, but was able to still go up and see shows and see friends. And so, it's worked out just fine. And I think it's even more so like that now than it was.
And also the Philadelphia Museum has got the steps that Rocky run up and down when he was training for all of his boxing competitions. So don't forget that.
And it's got the last work Duchamp ever made.
Oh, like, is it?
Right.
Yeah, that famous, the famous work. That you
the little
to,
room.
Like, peer,
look in.
Peer through the
talk door. Talk about a voyeuristic. Yeah, that one is wild.
Yes. That's real voyeurism. So we're going to get to our final questions now.
Okay.
If you could do an art heist, and I don't know if you collect art or do you trade with friends, if you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Yeah, I thought on this because I'm a big listener. So I was thinking, what would it be? And so my first thought was, like that it would be like the most transcendent time I had, which was when I saw Masaccio's expulsion painting of Adam and Eve in Florence. Like that floored me, but I think I would really struggle to live with that every day. And also the magic of it is so much about the fact that it is where it was painted. It still exists there. So I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that to everyone. But
maybe you could have like an art heist where you like put a chair in front of that work. And it's just reserved for you.
Okay. And then I was like, it should be probably Bonnard's table. I've looked at that painting so many times, the white tablecloth with the blue. It kind of floats in blue around it. But I actually have never seen that in person. I think it's there in London at the Tate, maybe. So I can't, I don't want to take something I haven't seen in person. So then I finally settled on there's this Biala painting. It's a snow scene out a window, and it kind of is the perfect painting to me. It's like got this line straight down the center that feels so symmetrical and like about the fact that you're looking at a painting, but then there's the illusion out into this back garden with snow, and it feels so simple at first. It feels so white and like nothing is there, and the longer you look, the colors start to really vibrate and reveal themselves, and it's just this quiet, beautiful painting that I think to have every day would be pretty magical. Plus, to think of her story, you know, as someone, I think that would just feel good to have this woman who, you know, painted into her late 90s. And
who is it? Who's the artist?
Janice Diala. So she's not so well known. Yeah. And I think that's all you could ask for, like to be in your 90s making paintings, but then, you know, however many years after your death, people come look and feel the magic of those. So that's what I would feel.
Love that.
Yeah.
The other question we ask every guest is a good one for you, considering your wonderful talent for color. What is your favorite color?
Yeah. I have always been, my favorite's always been green. So I would say green. And I think it can go very neutral and kind of grayish and silvery, but it can also go, I like that sort of, we were talking about earlier, that kind of acidy green, but it also, I think it reads in a way that can be very natural and pure and earthy, and then also kind of like putrid and repulsive. I don't know. There's something in it that is so nuanced, you know, where like, I always tell my friends, I struggle with red because it seems to assert itself so much as like what it should be. And they disagree with me. They think green is hard, but I think that what I like about it, it's very nuanced. And you can get to it so many ways. I don't actually buy a lot of greens, but you can mix so many beautiful greens.
It sounds like you like the challenge. You really do like the struggle, like you said
before. Yeah. That's a lot of struggle.
You don't want it easy. You don't just want the red out of the tube. You're like, I'm going to create different shades of green. When I asked you that question, in my head, I had lime green. I thought that's what you were going to say. And then you said green. I was like, oh my God, you're psychic.
Yeah. I like the things to appear easy and simple, but to really have been a struggle to earn that muddy green.
Cool. What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
I think to be sort of open to the vulnerability in making it. I think that, I don't know that anyone said that to me explicitly, but I think often I felt like I should be able to express, like I had said, like what is the work about and explain it clearly. And I think often to be vulnerable and to be to have doubt is to sometimes be dismissed, especially as a woman making paintings. Like, so sometimes I'll try to be more direct, but I do think the best paintings are made in that kind of struggling, vulnerable space. And I think I would say I learned that honestly from my friend who was a former teacher of mine, Bill Scott, and he's a master. I mean, first of all, he's lived 1,000 lives. He in his high school lived at Berthe Marceau's family's house. He lived at Joan Mitchell's in Paris. He's a scholar on so many things. And then to hear him talk, he's just so humble and approachable. And I think it's so nice to actually be able to understand and learn from that. I learned a lot from his generosity in that way. So, and watching people talk at him who knew like a quarter of the things that he had lived. So I think to embrace that vulnerability in making the work and trying to explain it is probably the thing I keep reminding myself of, that it's a good thing it's a good thing to be.
I think it also keeps it open for the viewer, doesn't it? And the empathy and everything. That's probably what we were talking about earlier too. For someone who paints food objects so frequently and even has the refrigerator series of food inside the fridge, what is your favorite snack?
In the studio, I've been having green apples a lot, but I don't know that that's my favorite.
I thought you were going to say cake.
Honestly, I'm not a big eater of cake, which is like, why am I painting? They look beautiful, but I'm more of a...
They do. They're luscious. Yeah. They're fluffy. Yeah. And
I like to
lots
look
of
at
icing.
Them. I like to look at them and I like to make them.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Which snack did you say?
No, I'm more salty. I think recently in the studio, I've had like a lot of green apples for some reason. I don't know. I don't really put enough thought into my snacks here. I think listening to everybody who has their snacks on here, I'm like, I should actually go to the store and buy some nice things and have them. But everything's very like messy and immediate in here. It's all.
But also, the apples are green and it's subliminal because it's the apple clock, isn't it? It's the apple clock.
Oh, that's
it's like
funny.
Look into my eyes. Do 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 do.
That's funny.
And that is going to be on display in London, everybody. You can see that painting.
My favorite thing I ever heard, like probably about painting, but it was on Talk Art also, is Len Girk said that the only way to keep an apple alive is to paint it. And like something about that, I wrote it down and I think about it. So perfect. So full circle.
Thank you for being a fan. That feels really humbling that you've written a quote down from Talk Art.
I thought that was so great. The only way to keep an apple
alive.
That's
interesting you mentioned Lens as well. I think anyone listening to this, and that if they haven't heard his interview, they'd... Because you know what? That was one of my questions I forgot to ask you, was how difficult is it to paint spaghetti?
He paints spaghetti.
I know, because he also paints spaghetti. That's what I was going to say. Because both of you have paintings, very elegant paintings, with spaghetti. And it seems like the most ridiculous and difficult thing to pin down or paint, let alone eat.
You've got a painting as well called Spaghetti Leftovers, I think, in a Tupperware box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My first show ever was called Spaghetti for Breakfast. It's always been a theme. I don't know.
Well, talking about Lens's work, you are going to be in a group show with Lens, Gjerk, and yourself that I'm curating, which opens on March the 4th at the Grimm Gallery in Mayfair in London. So everybody listening, come along. Aubrey's made an incredible painting in that, and you'll see an acid green sliced apple clock in that painting. So get excited and look for the signature in the bottom right-hand corner as well that's been scratched in. And what else have you got coming up? You have, as we said, at the Flag Art Foundation, you have the spotlight there at the moment, which I think is on for a couple more months, is it?
It's on until mid-March.
Okay, great.
And then I'm going to have some paintings at Ingleby Gallery, actually, in Edinburgh.
Great.
And so that's in June, and I'm hoping to come over and spend some time.
That's Caroline Walker's gallery, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We've interviewed Caroline Walker, and she's got work.
Yeah, they're an amazing gallery. Yeah. Well, if you do come over, that's going to give you a chance to go to the Tate and see Bonnard's.
Yes, I've already been thinking that. I know.
Yeah.
And then
it's so you, isn't it, that painting? The oranges in it. I just brought it up and the bananas and everything. It's very
I love that.
Yeah, I can see why you love it. Yeah.
And then the next big solo is in LA in September at M&B Gallery.
Oh, cool.
Brilliant.
Exciting times.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And we will link to all your galleries and share images of what we've been talking about today
on our
Instagram at Talk Art. And also you can visit at Grimm Gallery and you'll be able to visit Russell's show. It's free. So you should all pop down.
I'm so excited. Thank you for including me in that.
Of course. Thank you for being a part of it. I'm honored.
I've loved this conversation. It's been so wonderful. I feel like we're in the same room, even though we're not.
Yeah.
The magic of the internet.
And you said Fiona Apple to start, and the apple.
Oh, right.
I said Fiona
the
Apple, and it's
theme.
Green.
Wow.
Exactly.
The apple's been a theme. It's been the theme of this episode.
I love that.
Gosh, we're really stretching it now, aren't we? I think it's probably time to wish our listeners fond farewell and goodbye for now.
Thank you, everyone listening.
We'll be back very soon. And you're on Instagram?
Yes.
Are you? What's your Instagram?
It's just Aubrey Levendahl.
Okay.
Great.
At Aubrey Levendahl.
All right.
We'll be back very soon. Thank you, Aubrey.
Big love. Thank you.
I hope
you
get to see you when you come to the UK.
Yeah.
I'd love that. I'll come up to London. Maybe we can go and see the Bonnard together. That
would be
iconic.
Amazing.
Well, lots of love. We'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.